Good evening, and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Oshman Family Jewish Community Center in Palo Alto, California. My name is Marianne Lucchese Hamilton. It's an incredible pleasure to be here to introduce one of the most gifted, creative, and inspirational giants of the field of dance, Twyla Tharp. As an award-winning choreographer, Twyla has created over 100 pieces for the Joffrey Ballet, London's Royal Ballet, American Ballet Theater, and Twyla Tharp Dance, which she founded over 40 years ago. Working to the music of everyone from Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart, to Frank Sinatra and Bruce Springsteen, Twyla is a pioneer in melding modern dance and ballet with popular music. In film, she collaborated with celebrated director Milos Forman on Hair, Amadeus, and Ragtime. For television, she directed Mikhail Baryshnikov, and in the process took home 2 Emmy Awards. And for the Broadway stage, she directed the theatrical version of Singing in the Rain. And in 2003, she won a Tony Award for Movin' Out, which she conceived, directed, and choreographed to the songs of Billy Joel. For her contributions to American culture and the performing arts, Twyla has received a host of awards, including the 2004 National Medal of Arts, and she was a 2008 Kennedy Center honoree. Twyla is the best-selling author of Push Comes to Shove, and also The Creative Habit, Learn It and Use It for Life. Her newest book is The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a very, very warm welcome for my collaborator for the evening and yours, Ms. Twyla Tharp.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for coming. Is it possible to cut out some of the top light? That would be a very good thing, because I like to be able to see you more than I like you to be able to see me. I have here 2 books. This one is called The Creative Habit. It was the first, and it deals with how it is we work individually, how we go into an empty room if we're a dancer, how if we're a painter we look at a blank canvas or a writer an empty page, and what tools we can bring, what techniques, what procedures to make our life more bearable in the really bad moments and more enjoyable in the great moments. I'm going to leave that book for the moment and go on to its new kid brother, The Collaborative Habit. This one is about working with other people. And as it's the new one, it gets more attention at the moment. So I'll start with it. We can always refer back to the other, though, for those of you who might have read it. How many people, may I ask, have read The Creative Habit? Excellent. Good, good, good. And I hope you find it of use. And I hope you'll find value in this new one. It's organized fairly simply. It begins with, what is collaboration? Why is it important? And why is it that we see the word and the concept spoken of so much these days in terms of if we're going to survive as a planet, for example, we have to work together. If teams of all sorts work together, outsourcing, companies wanting to do research, ask for opinions, people think individually, still have to come up with an idea, but want to reflect it back on itself. They need someone to talk to. The next chapter takes this as a granted and acknowledges that collaboration is not necessarily an inherent human trait. Yes, I think mothers and infants are collaborative naturally. But then the ability to work well with others is something that has to be acquired. It is for a while necessary to put one's own ego aside. And as we're growing up, we are encouraged to express ourselves and become ourselves, and this is a good thing. But we also, if we are to work with others, need to learn lessons as to how that works. I was fortunate in that my mother, who I talk about quite a lot in the first book, made certain that my public school education was augmented with many, many lessons in many, many disciplines, mostly artistic, but kind of covering the boards, including, I like to remind everybody, stenography. In case everything else failed, I would be able to function. And, in fact, bless her, when first I got to New York, we were just talking about this, I was a Kelly temp. So it worked. She had provided me with all these many lessons in music and dancing and painting and so forth. And by the time I was 12, there were twin brothers, and she figured I should pass on some of the information. So part of my job was to educate, to train, to teach my twin brothers, Stan and Stan. Stan and Stan were identical twins, so named so they would not be miscalled by my parents. It was as I taught them dancing that I learned to tell Stan Ford from Stan Lee. Not by how they looked, but by how they moved. Stan Lee liked to go to the left, Stan Ford to the right, and so forth. And it was then that I understood through this collaborative process called teaching that I enjoyed learning how to identify and define people moving through space and time. In other words, I became a collaborator, and I became a choreographer at the same time. Choreography is, of all the art forms, the one that requires direct participation with others virtually from the get-go. Everyone else, composers have scores, writers have scripts. Only choreographers need to have other human souls and bodies as their material. So we need to learn how to access this resource. One of the ways that we can do this is just directly beginning. So shortly after I graduated from college, I began to work with a group of women. We were six, and we worked together for 5 years. And that's all we were. We were women. We did not use music. We had no costumes. We didn't dance on stages, but we had each other. And it was through this simple way of looking at others who were like ourselves. We were all women, but very different. Big Rose was 6 foot tall. Sarah was a very sinewy mover. Teresa was a terrific fast mind that identified movement in very peculiar ways. And this was all easier to register because we were so close. Small differences. Later, after the 5 years were up, we decided that we were perhaps being a little unfair here, that there were others on the planet, and so we began to allow a few men to come in. Also, around about this time, the singular opportunity came to work with Baryshnikov, and he was actually my first partner. I did not know anything about partnered movement. Girls, we did a little turning upside down. Maybe three of us could lift one of us, but that was about it. So when it came to partnership and dancing with, a male-female kind of relationship, I kind of started with a Stradivarius. The Stradivarius was fortunately understanding because he also was learning things from me. And this is the way that partnerships work best. We were extremely different, could not have had greater difference. And yet there was enough that was comparable between the two of us that we could find a platform to begin to work together. And we had a single goal. We both wanted to do the same thing. We wanted to change how people define dance. So that was a tacit understanding that we had. It was a good thing it was tacit because he only spoke Russian and I only spoke English. But we got through that part. And I'm glad to say we were able to make a peace that survives us both. After that, I continued to work with Misha for a period of time for a number of different projects, one of which was a partnership of a very different order, Misha and Greg Hines together. Again, two men, but very, very different. And this reminds me that, in my opinion, the single most important factor in a successful collaboration is respect. Both Misha and Greg were sublime at their particular callings and recognized it in each other, but would never attempt to be competitive. They were complementary, and those are the blessed partnerships. That's the third chapter. It's about working one-on-one. It's about being very different from someone else, and it is guaranteed that working with a partner, you will change. We hope for the better. The fourth chapter in this book is called Working with a Remote Collaborator. This came to pass through a project I did with the Miami City Ballet. It was a commission for a new piece, and the company had also commissioned Elvis Costello to write a new score. Costello, of course, has done a number of collaborations. He's had a lot of experience in this arena. He's a very charming man, very smart. His lyrics are fantastic. He's a real worker, and he's very, very busy. He missed his first deadline. He missed his second deadline. We needed to have a talk. And because he is the gracious man that he is, he said, look, maybe this is not going to work out, and maybe we should find a way to dissolve it that has some honor to it. And I said, no, we must try to pursue this because the company's invested too much in it, and we really have to deliver it. So, okay, you're going on tour, you're going to be completely unavailable. Never mind, we have MP3s. So he was working every time zone on the face of the earth. He would send in a little clip at night. I would be asleep, so there was no phone conversation. I have Final Cut Pro on my computer. I'd be editing videotapes, making DVDs, syncing in the new sound cues, sending them off to him, getting them translated into whatever kind of, you know, medium worked with whatever kind of power they had wherever he was, and getting back some kind of thing. Eventually, all of this was transferred to the living dancers and the living orchestra in real time in Miami. Essentially, it was a work by remote and through technology. Technology, of course, is a huge component in the current collaborative modes for corporations, for businesses, for governments, the teleconferencing worlds. I like to reference here my friend who is an oceanographer at with NASA, and clearly they have all the capacity for communications and technology that anyone might have access to, but my friend knows projects, knows himself, knows others well enough to still travel great distances on occasion to meet up face-to-face. There are times when information he feels can only be communicated in person. I think that artists working together prefer this mode, and that as a choreographer, I would far rather work with a composer who was in the studio and who could daily kind of breathe with what was happening than having to deal with one who's isolated off in another world. And our correspondence was this kind of machine-directed and machine-controlled, in a way, environment, because we could only do what the machines could do. I mean, he couldn't record just anything. He could only record what the devices would accept and vice versa. So the limitations that came through those machines impacted on our performers. That was not necessarily to anyone's advantage. On the other hand, it introduce some new kinds of modes. For example, some of the sounds that he got out of the band, I'm sure, would never have occurred if he had been in the studio in the first place with them. But as they tried to duplicate these machine sounds, strange things came out. And sometimes strange things are good things. So you make the most of it. That is another thing about collaborations. I'll say straight away that I've done a number of collaborations throughout the years. And while I have always had the legal, contractual, prenuptial arrangement that allowed me to remove myself before a premiere if I felt things were not going right, I've never pulled the plug. I have always pursued because I do believe that one of the most important things, one of the most important aspects of collaboration is that it gives us a tutorial in reality. We can all go in with our ideas, our fantasies, our hopes, our dreams, our wishes, and what we come out with is what can really be done. And it's a privilege to have this kind of learning experience. And as a collaborator, you have to put yourself in the head where you are not furious that what you want to have happen is not happening, but something else is, and look at that and say, okay, that's kind of interesting. I don't always get there in such a good-tempered way. At the time, it takes a little hindsight, but I am sharing these things with you. The next chapter is called Collaborating with an Institution. It has to do with how it is that artists can function in these huge conglomerates that essentially are status quo driven. They're run by folks who want everything to basically continue as it is because this is how things are and because this is how the pay structure is. And artists generally want to turn it upside down or at least see it change. I had here also good fortune in that the first institution I worked with, the first ballet company, if you will, was Bob Joffrey's. And Bob was an extraordinary company director. And when he invited me to make this ballet, he also made a commitment to become what in this chapter I refer to as my champion within the institution. He ran interference with his board of directors, with his dancers, with his publicity people, with everyone who's involved in getting a ballet up, so that I had only to go into the studio. That was the only job that he expected me to do. He would take care of all the rest. And from that, I learned that if you're going to go into an institution and you're trying to do something that is different, you really do need to have someone embedded in that institution who wants you to succeed and who is willing to acknowledge that your success means that that institution will change. Somewhat, Deuce Coupe changed the Joffrey Ballet, and Bob was willing to have that happen. So that's a very valuable lesson in working with big anonymous groups. The next chapter in this book is called Collaborating with a Community. That's what I'm doing now. I am interested in what people think. I am also interested to share some of the underpinnings, some of the mechanisms, some of the subtext of how I work, what I think a work is all about. That is not to say that when the curtain goes up, you will find me standing center stage telling you what the story is. I do expect the work to speak for itself, but I also know that we're curious and we like to know what's the motor under the hood. And I look at talking with communities, with audiences, as an opportunity to share this and also to learn from them. So that's a very important aspect of why collaboration is valuable. It's that people have expectations audiences coming to a performance have expectations. I think that it's very valuable that their expectations should be in line with what they're going to see. In other words, with billing, for example, in commercial projects, sometimes a producer will want to put something in the advertising or in the billing that will draw a crowd, but is not necessarily appropriate. It's false representation, and that is something that obviously I feel is not the way to go, and it guarantees disappointment to an audience. So when one collaborates with a community, it's very important to try to make what is going to come to pass be realistically available, to be accessible. Why not? The next chapter in this book is about collaborating with friends. I've had the good fortune of having very positive experiences here. This is a thin ice area. The rubric that guides is Love is Blind. Watch out. But in this chapter, I talk about working with three very, very good friends on a series of projects extending over many decades. Richard Avedon, I did over 25 sittings with throughout the course of 27 or 28 years. Jerome Robbins, I wrote a ballet with, and I knew Jerry for also a very, very long time. And Milos Forman, with whom I worked on three movies, and who is still a guy that I can talk to frankly about real issues. I call that a friend. Important thing here is to realize that one knows friends in special ways. As I think of it sometimes, their buttons. Where their insecurities are. Where they're sensitive. And in a collaboration, I always tried to be very aware to stay away from those and just try to stick to the work, excepting when you're having dinner, and then you can do something else. But you got to keep apples and oranges straight. So collaborating with friends has its dangers, but obviously it's an enormously rewarding way to work, because when you know somebody very, very well, you really trust them, which means that you trust yourself more, that you can try things that perhaps you wouldn't with somebody you don't trust, and also there's a huge economy. I'm working now on a show with a lighting designer named Don Holder, who is fantastic, and who literally is like, to me, a third arm in the theater. And we have very little verbal communication. I mean, in advance, he'll know the piece. We will have watched video a number of times, and we will have talked about the intention of a single scene, and we will have talked about the progression of scenes throughout the whole thing. But how he's going to do it, I never have a clue, and sitting in the theater when the scene begins to unfold from his point of view with the lights coming on, I'm invariably amazed to see that he's doing it in a way that if somebody had said to me he was going to do it, I'd say, "You're kidding." And it always works. So that's the collaboration that you really want to have, which is somebody who knows what they're doing and who's proven it to you a number of times. The last chapter in this book is called Flight School Before Your Next Collaboration, and in it I attempt to give some guidelines for determining what it is will help your next collaboration be even more successful than your last. How to think about what's needed for this collaboration to fit together, how to think about what you expect, how to think about what the other person might expect, and is it reasonable to think that these components are all going to mesh. I also, of course, always have to get in. You gotta do your exercises. You have to understand in a collaboration, you're not going to be working half as much. You're going to be working twice as much. You're going to be not doing someone else's job, not micromanaging someone else, but because of the amount of information coming into this project, they are exhausting. And you really want to be up for it physically. You want to be in shape. You want to be ready to take it on with the energy that's going to be required to make that commitment, because it's a major commitment. That's what a collaboration is. So that is the structure of this book. Seems pretty straightforward. It has this nice visualization on the front with two circles intersecting, one black, one white, and in the middle, we do not get gray, we do not get muddy white, we get red. Who would have thought? Surprise. A new lesson, something learned. That was a good collaboration where black and white got together and they made red. Great. So I am now, having gotten through, on the dot, half an hour, this book, we are now prepared for questions, which I'm looking forward to, because I hope that there will be meaning in this for you in your lives. And obviously what you do is very different from what I do, but I like to believe that lessons are common. So, how do we begin here? Shall I just take this lady's question up top? There's a question?
I think if we have a seat over here.
Okay, you want to do it that way?
Yeah. You've generated a lot of questions already.
Good.
Twyla, you make the point in both the collaborative habit and the creative habit that creativity isn't something that kind of flies in the window on the wings of angels, and it's not something that's accompanied by harps. It really requires a lot of hard work and routine and, in the best cases, rituals. Can you talk a bit about your rituals?
I get up as early as I can, and I try to work for 2 hours. It's pretty easy. You know, I do stretching, I do weights. I do some aerobics, I try to get to a point where I can forget about my body. I don't have to worry about it, and I can just let it move. But it's the exercising that puts me into a groove to get going with the more free-form thinking. There's a rumor, and probably true, maybe, possibly, that Stravinsky, before he composed, always played a Bach prelude to get himself going.
Okay. When you produced your dance called Eight Jelly Rolls that was based on the music from Jelly Roll Morton, you said it was the first time you took on a new collaborator, the audience. What was that new element, what did that mean to you, and what were the ramifications of that?
Well, I suddenly, after 5 years of working or 5.5 years of working, was tired of causing the audience a lot of pain. So I said, okay, would it really be so hard on me to let them have a little pleasure? They should maybe be able to enjoy it a little. Not too much, just a little. I made sure that the audience should understand that it was okay to laugh by throwing in some spratfalls and otherwise making some comic moves, and found that chopping the ice barricade between me and the audience was a different way of working, and ultimately probably preferable.
No doubt. All right. What role does a sense of humor play in collaboration, and can it hurt a collaboration if it's used to gloss over differences?
Sense of humor can't hurt anybody ever. Sense of humor is the way you get through it. When sometimes there's a real impasse, rather than going, you motherfucking son of a... Damn it! Don't do that. Don't go there. Find a way to do it with humor. You'll get better results, I promise.
Words to live by, okay? A member of our audience wanted to know how you got the opportunity to work with Baryshnikov. I'd like to add, can you describe your first meeting with him?
Yes, to both. Misha saw a ballet I did, the second ballet that I did for Joffrey. You're not taking a picture, are you? Because I don't have on makeup. That would not be good. That would be bad. Thank you. Saw the second ballet I did for the Joffrey called As Time Goes By. And he decided that I could make a dance. So he would ask me to make a dance for him, which was actually pretty brave of him. I agreed to come and see him rehearse. I didn't agree to make the ballet because it was nice that he wanted me. I wasn't sure that I wanted him because I wasn't sure that I could work with him, that I could serve him well, that I could accommodate him, that I could make him look good, that I knew enough about what it was he did, because he was a sublime classical dancer. Did I know enough about what classical ballet was to implement his talent in such a way that it would shine? This is another thing about collaboration. You have to want it to succeed. You have to want that your collaborators look good. So the first time I met Misha was in a rehearsal, and I think he was probably rehearsing Giselle. I said, oh, well, he's interesting beyond just the classical vocabulary, and to cinch it, because he was both a clown and an athlete, at the end of the rehearsal, before I could get out, he did a somersault and landed like this. And I said, okay, we'll do it.
You couldn't turn that one down. Those of us who've watched and marveled over your career for about four decades might be surprised to hear that you were born into a Quaker family in the Midwest, and you spent a lot of time hanging out at the drive-in. How did that early environment shape you as a dancer and as a collaborator?
I didn't hang out at the drive-in. I worked at the drive-in. My family owned the drive-in. I made hot dogs. I bagged popcorn. I sold tickets. I worked at the drive-in. And I learned a lot from working at the drive-in, particularly about when movies got boring, because that's when I had to be in there serving popcorn and hot dogs. Also, I learned about what entertained people, and I learned how tolerant people are. I learned about the responsibilities of entrepreneurial behavior. And because my parents were business people, I grew up thinking that art earned its way, that it was a commercial venture. So I think that had a very big impact on my career. I never expected to be subsidized.
Okay. Did you choose Pomona College because of the dance department, or was that where your family happened to be living at the time?
My mother chose Pomona College because it was not too far from home. I chose Barnard because it was very far from home.
How did Mom react to that?
She went along with it.
Okay.
My mother was always a pretty good sport.
Good deal. How has your success later in your career affected your creative process now?
I think that success, obviously, it can't be taken for granted. It does nothing but guarantee you get one more chance. But you do get one more chance. The success is of a healthy sort, it means that the opportunities that come can be expanded upon are not going to run away with you. And I like to feel and do feel that the reason I can keep working is because I see continuity, and that some of the issues that I started with have snowballed. Success allows one to keep going. It can also stop one. Become defining. Too much success of a sort can turn a person from an investigative force into a brand. That's not a good thing. But I've always tried to see it as an avenue to the next step.
Thank you. For our radio audience, we're speaking with dance innovator and legend Twyla Tharp. Twyla, how have you managed to work through injury and managed to keep a balance between family and work in your 40 years in dance?
Oh, dear, injury and family in the same question.
It's a frightening.
Injury, well, Always some part still works, okay? And so I look for the part that's working and try to let the other parts rest until they're up to it. Family is very difficult. I'm blessed with a wonderful son who now, hello everybody, 4 weeks ago, had a son of his own. Oh, yeah, right? So he is very generous and very understanding. And we have managed to find a way. It's not easy to be a full-time committed artist and have children. There are lots and lots of difficulties, but there is also lots and lots of love and empathy.
Fantastic. All right, this one's for me. I was very, very fascinated by the lessons you learned from working with Milos Forman in the film version of Hair. He previously won 5 Oscars for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and so he could easily have gotten away with being sort of the prototypical tyrant director, but instead you say in your book that he was actually quite a gentleman, and in fact he sort of auditioned for you. What did you take away from that kind of collaboration?
The most important thing about Milos as a director is that he is capable of completely submerging his ego into the working process and refers to the film as the baby. Everybody has to do what's good for the baby. He doesn't care whose idea some concept is. If it's good for the baby, it's good for him. I think that's a terrific way of being, and it also allows a director to pull back and try to get beyond personal taste, which is not always the best thing for the baby.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you put in a 2-hour warm-up every morning. You try. What does that consist of?
I do an intensive sort of stretching with a lot of resistance to it, a sort of isometric stretching. I do some calisthenics. I do, you know, some push-ups, some handstands, some upside-down abs that I really enjoy myself. And I do weight training still, and I do a bar still, a very bad bar. It's very ugly. But I do it. And I do at least 30 minutes of aerobics. And on a good day, when I don't have to make tons of phone calls and a whole lot of email, I will also get some time to actually make some dancing.
Is there ever a morning when you just say, I just can't do this?
You can always do something. You maybe can't always do your very finest routine, but you can always do something. And believe me, something is better than nothing.
Is that big empty white room's always waiting for you?
That's right.
Okay. What's been your biggest and most successful challenge, and what did you learn from the process?
Well, I think probably in any kind of difficult collaboration, just the notion that, okay, there's going to be a way through this. I don't know what it is. Sometimes I do look at it as a storm, and I do sometimes look at it as being at sea, and that you, that I am intent on not going down.
That's a guarantee. Twyla, how do you handle the multiple master situation where various people or client groups are asking for disparate answers for the project?
No, I'm sorry. I don't understand that question. Multiple what?
Multiple masters.
What does that mean?
I think a lot of people are pulling you a lot of different ways when you're in the middle of a project. And how do you stay true to your vision?
Oh, the reason I don't understand what that question is because it would never occur to me to abandon my vision, no matter what anybody is going at me with. I think actually it's very important in collaborations that one retain a sense of identity. On the one hand, you have to give up want to get beyond yourself, want to be generous about working. And on the other hand, you never want to forget what your strong points are, what your business being there is, and what your intention is, what your goal is. Many masters, and that's another thing. The reason I didn't recognize that question is because I don't think of masters in collaboration. Bosses are in work for hire. They're not in collaboration. There's no master in collaboration. There are people working together. And as the project, rolls along, someone is going to seem to be in the lead, but that can always flip back and forth. No one's the boss in a collaboration.
Even when you have an ego, a director, a dancer, I mean, all of those are very, you get a lot of alpha males together on a project. How does that work when?
There's a difference between conflict and tension. In tension, you have, I have my share of ego. And my share of ego with someone else's share of ego can have a lot of tension to it. This, I think, is a very good thing because it means that you get read as opposed to some kind of just blend. Did I answer that question, I hope?
I think you did.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Okay. We'll pass that one up. What advice do you have for a choreographer first starting out?
Work hard. Work hard to find your own way. Work hard to see if you really care enough to do this. Because rather than spending 5 years to be a choreographer, if you can learn in 5 months that you really don't care enough, then you've saved yourself time. If you find that you're curious every day, if you find that going into a studio continues to be an exciting, more exciting than fearful experience, certainly more exciting than boring experience, then there's reason to continue. But I think that the question really for a young person beginning to work is, do I belong in the studio? Don't just assume that you're going to come out with a dance, because you're not for quite a long time, and don't expect it of yourself. That's the wrong question in the very beginning.
Okay. In your book, you talked about your collaboration with Bob Dylan as being maybe one that wasn't as successful as your others for a variety of reasons.
That would be incorrect. It's not that it was not successful. Different. It was controversial.
Controversial, okay. Yes.
They're different.
And you had used music, more of his romantic songs, when you felt that he's really more known for his protest songs, and those are the ones that are... maybe incite more passion in people?
Okay. What I say in the book is that the piece was controversial basically because the audience came expecting to see something that was very different ultimately on stage than what they thought Bob Dylan was about. They were not fully prepared to look at this, and that was a big problem. What I say in the book is that my first instinct with Bob's music was to stay within his love songs, and he has written 40 or 50 really good love songs and 25 or 30 classics. What happened as the show became a show and producers and so on became more embedded in the project, they wanted the more commercial songs, the songs that people know, some of the protest songs, a greater variety than Bob's love songs, which are not amongst his more popular pieces, in looking to incorporate this other material, I lost track of my original instinct. And this is in the last chapter, and I talk about having passed through that experience, realizing that I had gone away from a first instinct and returning to it to get me to the next one, which is the show that's going up in March on Broadway with Sinatra Recordings. I worked with Sinatra 3 times before. This is my 4th pass with the Sinatra, but it is informed by the Dylan Love songs that I did not use.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Do you plan to use hip-hop and other current dance forms in your choreography?
Listen, I rep it off all the time.
Any kind of movement, is it?
That's wonderful. Right.
Okay. How did you approach the collaboration with Baryshnikov and Gregory Hines, given the serious undertones of political strife in Russia?
The collaboration of those two dancers really had nothing to do with the political situation in Russia. It had to do with the political situation between tap dancing and ballet.
All right. Thank you. This is a note from an audience member. Thank you for the master's class you gave to us at UCLA in the 70s. It was amazing. Since then, I gave up dancing.
Oh. Oh, I guess I was successful.
And embraced improv.
Uh-huh.
The closest thing I've found to modern dance.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of combining improv comedy with modern dance? I'd love to collaborate.
I appreciate that. I think I have quite enough comedy in my life for the moment. But I appreciate the thought. Thank you.
Okay. Have you ever turned down a collaboration, and why?
Probably, but I've managed to forget it.
You said you don't gossip. Yes.
That's right.
Okay. How do you find and choose collaborators? Or do they find you?
Both. When there's a project where, for example, a scenic designer, Santo Laquasto has worked with me for a very, very long time, a number of pieces, but for the new Sinatra, he just was not available. There was no way that he could do it. So I was forced to find a new collaborator in an area where I'd come to be dependent on Santo, and he's masterful. So I began by asking people who I respected for recommendations and then set about doing research. Research is really important in selecting collaborators, both to find who's appropriate and to help clarify for yourself exactly what are you asking for. So it's a two-edged sword, this business of auditioning, and I came up with someone that actually I'm very happy with, but because basically he was recommended by Don Holder, the lighting designer, and I knew I could trust Don, and so when I started doing my research, I wasn't in a void.
Okay, thank you. You talked about having a champion in Joffrey. How important is it to have a champion?
It's impossible to work, I think, in an institution productively if you don't have a champion, because you don't know the politics of the institution. And anyone who's ever worked, for example, inside a university knows that there's a great deal of diplomacy that goes on, and if you want to get something done, you need a chancellor who knows what you do, why you're valuable. Otherwise, you're going to be spending a lot of your time doing politics. It's true in the corporate world. It's true for me working in a ballet company. There's got to be somebody who's going to do all the skullduggery that gets the fundraising done, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so I can do the dancing.
Do you still have a champion?
It comes along with the territory. I mean, any project one needs. You don't outgrow champions. You need all the help you can get.
So are you constantly cultivating new ones?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite in that way. I mean, I'm. What do you have in mind? Maybe I can take something here from this page.
I just was wondering if it's an ongoing process, no matter how much success you've had over four decades, if you're always looking for the next challenge and if that requires a new champion to help you get to that point.
Yeah, every project is going to be different, and you, as I say, you need all the help that you can get. But it's not, I mean, I think that there's a tendency, and it's hard not to go this way, to become politically inclined or to deal with the business of doing art, and you need help. There, you need focus for the art that you do, and you don't want to be cultivating. You don't want to do cocktail parties. You don't want to have to do galas. You do not want to have to do dinners and currying, et cetera, et cetera. You need somebody whose business that is. It's a full-time job.
Absolutely. And that sort of leads to, in which decade did you feel that the arts were the most supported, and do you see that being a resurgence with our new administration?
It's apples and oranges. I mean, how work got done in the 60s is very different from how work got done in the 70s and so on and so forth. And one attempts to navigate the shoals as best as possible. In the 60s, there was very little subsidy, certainly for me. I mean, I was beginning, plus which my career in altering means that my opportunities alter. But on the other hand, in New York, we could hard scrabble and come up with spaces for nothing where we could sneak in. We could create work that got done in shopping malls and we didn't get thrown out. Strange things could happen, and you could call it dancing in the 60s.
You danced in a cow pasture, I understand?
But not in the 60s. That was in the early 70s. In the 70s, funding did become a possibility. There were state funding agencies that had quite a bit of money. I received my first grant, which was a Guggenheim, and the federal government began a program called the Dance Touring Program, which was very, very, very valuable in the 70s and the 80s. At that point, subsidy began to be distorted by controlling interests, political controlling interests, and that kind of funding became rarer and rarer. That was one of the deciding factors in my determining to disband my company in the late 80s, because it seemed to me that probably not-for-profit was going to change radically. And I, at that point, became a freelancer and started working commercially. I am always concerned about how dancers are supported, about what mechanisms can feed them, can house them, all the things that everybody needs to have. And this company going up in the Sinatra is actually the dancers. There are a number of dancers in it who have worked with me in all three of the Broadway shows, but also in my traveling company, who do teaching for me. So in essence, we are a repertory company, and we're supporting ourselves commercially. So that is a new paradigm.
Does part of that require political activism then to ensure the ongoing funding?
It's commercial. It requires selling tickets.
Fair enough. All right. A number of our audience members are interested in purchasing your programming.
Oh,
are those
good
for sale?
My book.
Your book?
Okay, guys, let's go. Thank you.
Specifically, they were curious about your program with Baryshnikov and with Philip Glass. Are those videos available anyplace?
Oh! Actually, they're not. That's not true. The Mishra, there is a tape called Baryshnikov by Tharp that has Push Comes to Shove, The Little Ballet, and Sinatra Suite on it, and that is available commercially. The Glass is not. It's currently in legal hassle, this, that, and the other. So it'll get sorted out one day.
Okay. We're talking with Twyla Tharp, legendary author and, well, now an author, choreographer and dancer. One of our audience members asks, in the South Bay area, it's been difficult to find a sustainable model for modern dance. Do you have suggestions for how to set up a more sustainable model, I guess?
I think that everywhere is very different. I mean, what's going to work in one climate is a different beast I'm sure. I mean, I think that one has to be very risk-taking in terms of developing mechanisms for supporting the arts. And I wouldn't, I mean, I'm sorry the question is just too general. I wouldn't have a way of approaching it. Who asked that question? No. Oh, good. Because can I talk to him a minute?
Absolutely.
Good. What are you doing?
Well, I'm just kind of talking about SJ Dansko, who's one of the sponsors tonight. Uh-huh. They're just trying to come up with something that will really continue to make things happen, trying to grow this company. It continues to grow, but it struggles with getting space in a theater and, you know, just being able to, I don't know, sustain that kind of season.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, what I would suggest is, and I, again, forgive me because I don't know the company, but that maybe the cost of the theater is a burden that is not worth it, and maybe there are other venues that can be found and developed, and maybe that will help also find you a whole nother audience and challenge your publicity, for example, to get people to bizarre and strange places where bizarre and strange things might be happening rather than simply, you know, to this same old theater where maybe they think they're going to see the same old thing, even though you know they're not. So, you know, that's one of the things I meant by, you know, just try different approaches. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And tell me you've already done this?
Right now it's been based mainly at the university, and it's been branching out toward a bigger theater. The audience continues to grow, but the venue needs to change in order to bring in more audience.
Uh-huh. Right. No, absolutely. And that's a positive challenge. That's a great thing. So, you know, sometimes when things aren't working, this is good. Right? Yeah.
Okay. Twyla, in terms of nurturing young dancers to grow into collaborative artists, what's your opinion of the current craze for competitive dance programs?
My take on any art form is the more the merrier. That anything that helps the public be exposed to movement and what people think dancing is all about is a good thing for the art form. The notion, however, that competition is so involved is a distortion. Dancing is, sure, it can be done competitively, but that's not really when it's the most powerful. When it's the most powerful is when you're making demands on yourself. I think that perhaps competition skews that, particularly for youngsters. It's not about going up against somebody else.
Do you think it does a disservice by sort of showing that you can learn a rumba in a week and...
Oh, that's great.
Yeah?
Sure. That's not going to be maybe the rumba couple of the century that's going to go on for a lifetime, but the idea that dancing is not inaccessible, which is what I meant when I was being glib about that's great, learning it in a week. Dancing is not inaccessible. Great dancing is inaccessible. That's what's hard.
This is a really important question. What kind of athletic shoe are you wearing?
These are Triple E Nikes. All right, walking shoes. They're supposed to have some support. I actually don't care for them. I tried to get Nike to work on a better idea a long time ago, which essentially is actually beginning to happen, a kind of moccasin. I mean, the problem with heavy sneakers is that they give no mobility to the foot. It's like paddle and roll. It actually kind of atrophies the foot. And in a moccasin, there's more flexibility to work through the instep. I mean, the question is actually a very good one because foot gear determines determines completely what the dancer is going to be able to do. Obviously, in a point shoe, you're going to work very differently from in a tap shoe. So I even tried to get a shoe company, Familari, at one point to make me a toe tap shoe. That didn't work out.
There's still hope.
There is.
There's still hope. Do you think it's better to jump into as many opportunities as possible, or is there a way to decipher from the get-go that there may not be the best time for something?
Yeah, if there's any hesitation, don't do it. The best collaborations are ones that happen easily. They're ones that the pieces fall together. There's not a lot of struggle. There's not a lot of wrenching. We got to make it this. We got to go here. It seems a natural pairing, and that's what one wants to have happen. I mean, if you have to work too hard to get a deal in place, probably you don't want to do it. Hesitation is not a good thing.
But when you're starting out, the impulse is to try and do as much as possible in case the opportunity doesn't arrive again.
Well, what are you thinking here specifically?
I'm thinking of, for myself, being a writer.
Uh-huh.
If I turn down this project, will I have work?
If you don't turn down a project that doesn't make sense to you and it goes south, that doesn't help you. Right?
Exactly.
So if you feel from the get-go that the thing does not have a potential, it's not really an opportunity. If there's a question mark about it and you think that there's something that you can learn in it or something that you can extend from it, then try it. If it seems like it's fish in a barrel, that's great. That's kind of the spectrum. You can't be desperate about work. It's better to not take an opportunity than to take one that you have a sinking feeling in your tummy about.
Okay. This is sort of a vague one, but what's your advice for a 40-year-old dreamer? How to become a choreographer when he or she has no professional training? Is it even possible?
I like that question. It's totally possible. One would need a very, very strong calling, but Isaac Dennison, for example, did not start writing until she was in her early 40s. Scarlatti did not start composing until he was probably in his mid-40s. Examples of great artists who are late starters. Not having any training, that's a problem. Dennison had been doing a lot of reading. She had a very firm grasp of several languages when she started to write. And that would be something to think twice about. But I could imagine being 40, knowing nothing whatsoever about dancing, deciding that I could see a way that people could move together and going for it. I did a piece called The 100s a long time ago, and there are components of it that are very difficult and require highly skilled dancers, but one portion of it asks to have 100 individuals completely untrained, doesn't matter who they are. We've had people, physically disabled people, participate in it. It's 100 11-second segments of movement, each of which is like a little haiku, a beginning, middle, and an end. And it's designed for everybody to do, for anybody to do who wants to dance. And it's taught very quickly in 10 minutes, and then everyone gets the opportunity to do it. Now, granted, it's 100 people performing simultaneously for 11 seconds. I'm not taking that much of a risk with the untutored, shall we say, but it was that kind of vision.
Mind-boggling.
No, not mind-boggling. That movement and that dance and that a dance could be done by people who had no training, no experience, and only had faith, hope, and dreams that they got an opportunity to perform on stage. This piece has been done a lot. And one I still remember, it was performed once in London, and this woman came in, and she was totally committed to her 11 seconds and how she was going to prepare for it and learning and doing. And it was a monumental experience in her life. She says, look, I'm a bank teller. I've always wanted to dance. What could be better?
Outstanding. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question. So, Twyla, what do you want to be remembered for? Is there a signature move that you love?
I don't want to be remembered. I want to keep living. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Twyla.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed tonight's program, brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Twyla Tharp, award-winning choreographer and author of The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together, our audience here in Palo Alto, California, and those of you joining us on radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.